them, and very nice facilities.
That was Telnak, some of Telnak's inspiration.
Jack Telnak kicked it off, yeah. It was, he provided the impetus for it and moved out of Geelong, never got an opportunity really to see the... the fruition of his works, but
you probably had a dual personality there in the sense that you were designing for the cities and the outback as well.
Yes, as a matter of fact, the city is very much like ours,
right.
Except that when I first went down there, it was like going through a time warp. You flew into a city that had streetcars, like I remember as a kid in Washington to see your trams.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Many, many little businesses, very few highways, no supermarkets kind of thing. It was like suddenly being transported back pre-World War II, Maryland, Virginia, Washington, D.C. area for me.
Mm-hmm.
And but then in the outback, you know, an hour's drive would take you into, you know, Nowheresville.
Right.
And they had special high-ride suspensions. They had very stringent sealing problems for the dust in the outback.
Oh, yes.
Very stringent requirements for protection of the engine from the dust. All cars had air extractors because of the high temperatures, very little AC at that time, although the air conditioning has come into its own. And surprisingly enough, they had a very high quality level that was demanded by the consuming public, because it was a the per capita income wasn't all that great, and the car was quite an investment, much more so than the U.S. So the paint finishes and things had to be right top notch, and the quality had to be good, or you got the thing back. It was and, you know, no bloody why was any Aussie going to take any any quality that wasn't first rate.
Did you have a rust problem there?
They did have a rust problem in the coastal areas,
yeah.
Brisbane,
yeah.
Salt Spray. Most of the time, when I got down there, I was amazed to see little Falcons and old cars running around just as pristine as the day they came out of it. Because they took good care of the car in a very dry climate, tended to preserve them. But demanded a high quality, and they got it. And it was a very difficult thing, because the new Australians, the immigrants into Australia, the first place they would head for jobs was the auto plants.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have to know the language, and they had signs in the plants in five different languages. So they worked on the line until they could master some of the language. And then I think in the Sydney plant they had a 300% turnover 1 year. So the quality was difficult to achieve with that kind of turnover.
Certainly to maintain.
Yeah, to maintain it.
Yeah. So the styling influences then were pretty much what the buying public was asking for.
Well, the image cars in Australia, it was different than the U.S. The image cars down there were Mercedes, BMW, Jaguar.
Mm-hmm.
The American cars, of course, were left-hand drive and were known as Yank tanks. The British cars and the European cars with right-hand drive were the preferred cars, or their export models.
Yeah.
And so most of the image cars were the European. And the Yank tanks were regarded as much too big a slug. And you saw them occasionally around Melbourne and Sydney, but most of them you saw at Pine Gap and Alice Springs, out where the missile tracking stations were.
Yeah.
I had to go into the center of Australia and see all these old Dodges and Birds and Mercuries the U.S. employees had brought over there. And you know, they weren't converted in the Northern Territory. The rules weren't too stringent as to which side of the road you drove on, or there weren't that many out there. So Pine Gap had a lot of Yank tanks.
The XD Falcon was one of your creations there.
Yeah, that was the car that I was responsible for.
How'd that come about?
that car was really an interpretation of the European Granada on the Falcon chassis suited to Australia for both manufacturing reasons and marketing reasons. It was a not a copy by any means, but I would say the general theme of the car was very much the Granada, the European Granada of that era, because it was a fairly advanced car, had a good feeling. I kind of split the difference between BMW, Mercedes, those cars that were the image cars in Australia. And we simply picked up the theme and utilized it. Interpreting, it was really a better looking car in my mind, because we weren't restricted by carryover doors like the Granada was. We had aero headlamps to work with. We had a wider stance. So although it was that theme, I always felt it was a little more gutty, solid looking car. Very successful car in terms of, well, it just, you know, the poor old GM Holden.
Holden, yeah.
Yeah, GM Holden, GMH down there, that it just slaughtered the Holden, the Statesman, and those cars that they had down there.
They're just now recovering after all these years.
Yeah, I think they've recovered somewhat. I think they had a little bit of a, you know, we had 60% of, GMH had 60% of the market,
right,
after, right after World War II. And they were gradually chewed up by the Japanese penetration and the Ford the Ford succession, without really realizing what it was happening to them. They sort of went on their merry way thinking they were invulnerable, and they weren't.
Yes. The Japanese influence is becoming felt at this point in the early 70s.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, when I went down there, where they were importing Estacorts and Cortinas from England, because of being a right-hand drive company, country, and the quality wasn't all that good. And the Japs were coming in with better quality and better economy, and a lot of the industries in Australia are protected, so the quality of the vendors submitting the components wasn't that good. And the Japs were making inroads. They were really doing the job. And Chrysler had the Mitsubishi. They had a Gallant and a Lancer down there.
Chrysler of Australia.
Yeah, mm-hmm. You know, which doesn't exist anymore, I don't believe. I think it's gone. But they had a nice line of mostly Japanese-sourced cars. Mm-hmm. And of course, Ford has since transferred its... they've gotten TK Mazda as a Japanese partner. And the Telstar and those vehicles now are Japanese sourced, the front-wheel drive vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
They had to have an economical way of going from rear-wheel drive to front-wheel drive because of its success. But the big Falcon, Fairlane, the LTD, are still rear-wheel drive.
And they're still selling them.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, let's see, what was Don Thompson, who worked for me down there, was in the hall in the design center today, and when I went at the lunch, there was standing Don Thompson. He says that they had taken the old straight six, 250 cubic inch six, put a Bosch Jetronic induction system on it, fuel injection system, and it made a very nice engine, which is called the Cherry engine program. And that's been doing very well for them, because they phased out their big Cleveland V8s. You know, the fuel prices down there went up similarly to what ours did, although they were always fairly high. They didn't get incapacitated like we did by the Arab oil embargo, because they have a tremendous ability. They have a lot of sources in Bass Strait. They pump a lot of their own oil right out of Bass Strait between Tasmania and Australia. There's a large oil field there. And,
did you have any input into the laser?
No. I was gone by the time the cars that I worked on were the Escorts, the Cortinas, the trucks, F-Series trucks, and the L-Series trucks we introduced while I was down there.
All went very well, as I recall.
Yes, yeah, they were quite successful. The Laser and the Telstar, I was back here by the time that they had made contacts with TK. I forget, let's see. The guys, Andy Jacobson was down there. Jim Arnold followed me down as chief designer. He was only there about 18 months and he was brought back. And Andy Jacobson went down. And then at that time, Brian Engels was asking me as to who I would recommend as a local Australian that would, you know, could succeed to the design job, because they wanted to, the Yanks were pretty expensive to billet and keep down there, and they were trying to get a guy trained to the point, and John Dowdy was the obvious. John Dowdy's now the chief designer, and who's, you know,
he's one of your proteges there.
Yeah, local Australian that just doing a bang up job.
So this tour of duty gave you an interesting perspective on different types of design procedures.
I got much more acquainted with both the Japanese products and the European products, which proved immensely valuable when I came back here, since the Japanese and the Europeans had such an influx of vehicles.
What was the, tell us a bit about, you've noted here the Mini-Max, can you tell how that came about?
The Mini-Max was really designed around 1969, 1970 by Ken Spencer.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Ken finally said, hey, you know, where are we going to go? We can't go lower and lower forever. You know, suppose you change your thinking and say, hey, maybe taller and narrower is better because people can get in and out. And came up with this little Mini-Max package, which I believe he named. I remember him working on that thing. It was the first time we had access to any little V6 engines, or V4 engines, I think, that were out of the Cardinal program, which came from the Taunus program in Germany.
Yes.
So he did this little narrow high minivan type of package and called it the Mini-Max. Nobody was interested in it. You know, he was just the Mercury Advance guy at that time. So it didn't go anywhere. And then when I came back from Australia, I guess Ken had been director of this advanced area.
Which you were about to take over.
Yeah, which I took over when I came back from Australia. And so Ken and I were working together. He was the exec and I was the director.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were given the assignment of doing another van project. And we had what we call the Mini-Max van, and we had what we call the Carousel van, which was a big Econoline front engine rear drive type job. And so he kind of resurrected, and we collectively resurrected his concept of the Mini-Max, and did it, and Lee Iacocca got interested in it. But we still didn't have any front-wheel drive platforms at that time. We did the vehicle, we researched it. Lou Verali built it in metal down on Michigan Avenue down there in Inkster. Lee drove it up and down the expressways and was enthusiastic about it. Research great, but Lee had been shot down at that time by Mr. Ford as to bringing in Honda engines, front-wheel drive transaxles, and doing small cars. And so we had no front-wheel drive platforms to do it on, even though it researched like gangbusters. Well, when Mr. Ford punted Lee through the goalpost, so to speak, Lee simply said, hey, the K-car's platform is here. I can do my Mini-Max. So the Voyager van on the road today is virtually the Mini-Max.
Which was Ken Spencer's...
Which was really Ken Spencer's inspiration back around 1969, 1970. So here, what, 15 years later?
Yeah.
About 15 years later, There is Ken's vehicle running around at Chrysler under the auspices of Lee Iacocca, who literally took the concept with him and built it on the K-Car platform at Chrysler.
Was Hal Sperlick involved in that at all?
Hal Sperlick really wasn't involved. He had gone to Chrysler a couple of years
earlier
because he too had incurred the wrath of the high mucky mucks by wanting to do front wheel drive small cars, you know, and Henry had misread the market and said, hey, you know, those things will never fly.
Right.
Let's do the Fiesta in Europe, you know, that's where it belongs.
And he'd love that car.
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah. Neat little car.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was the Wolf program in Europe. So that's the history of Minimax and Plymouth Voyager.
That's fabulous. So you were there for a couple of years working on special projects, an international and advanced concept.
Mm-hmm.
And then you moved into the mainstream of midsize.
I guess that was the era in which we did the. I guess I was never involved in the genesis of the 80 Bird because I was just getting back from Australia.
Mm-hmm.
The 80 Bird was more or less there, but I got in charge of the studio for Bird, Cougar, Mark, and Lincoln.
Mm-hmm.
And during that interim, we did the finished up the 80 Bird and did the facelifts on that and got into the 83 Bird Cougar program.
Mm-hmm.
And in the what led to the Mark 7, today's Mark 7, was the what we call the Lincoln Concept 90. The original model was reworked and became a show car as the Lincoln Concept 90. And then I guess I went off into Never Never Land as a director of design services and trim and color. So I wasn't working directly on any specific car line for a couple of years there until I got caught in the whirlwind of demotions and cutting back and stuff like that, and then I got put in truck studio.
This is quite a sort of a quantum leap era, isn't it, in the late 70s, and you're really coming up with some really incredible new concepts.
Well, I think the desire to do them had always been there, but marketing had such a stranglehold conceptually on what was acceptable, and everybody was in so much trouble with fuel consumption.
Mm-hmm. Right.
There was kind of a desperation move and a recognition of the fact that with proper aerodynamic styling, you could save hundreds of millions of dollars of driveline engine improvement.
Mm-hmm.
So all of a sudden, the lid came off,
right,
and we were allowed to, and absolutely mandated that we should go to the wind tunnels and get these things more fuel efficient. The C sub D's became gospel.
Mm-hmm.
Get them down. The coefficient of drag.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Coefficient of drag is utilized. You know, the numbers are utilized to in advertising now, since people are conscious of fuel consumption and aero.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden the lid came off, and I'm almost afraid that we've moved too quickly.
Mm-hmm.
That it's going to take some education and some.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Bird and the Cougar are successful, and I think the Tempo Topaz is good, but those cars are in fact going to have to educate the public into an acceptance of the aero look, and with the availability of fuel and the leveling off of prices, you know, there's not quite the pressure now for that kind of performance in the eyes of the public. I'm concerned that the Illinois hog farmer and the Kansas grain farmer and the guy in Texas is still going to like his old Panther Lincoln town car concept,
sure,
which we have virtually annihilated. You know, there's not many plants building those things anymore. We've got a lot of.
Where is the actual
Oh, the St. Louis facility that builds the Mercury will be phased out for Aerostar vans. It's being transferred to St. Thomas, Ontario.
Is it?
The only luxury cars we have are being built up at Wixom, you know, mm-hmm. Continental, Marks, Lincoln Town cars. Mm-hmm. So the buying public is so fickle that we
managed to be pretty fluid.
Yeah, that's right.
So back in the late '70s, of course, you, as you well remember, that you've got the downsizing controversy, you've got the fuel crisis, and you've got a sort of a crisis in management too. If not at the top, in the design center.
Well, we had. I was in Australia for those early '70s years.
Mm-hmm.
And there was the rather grim recession where I came back from. I left in 73, and the fuel crunch occurred really late 73, 74, and a recession ensued in 75.
Mm-hmm.
I can remember coming back on my first home leave from Australia and going into the design center in that whole lower hall. There were 60 Hamilton boards with their boards set up vertically, all stashed in the lower hall with the lights turned down low, and it looked like a tombstones or a graveyard.
Yeah,
what an awful
mausoleum.
Yeah, it was really a grim feeling around here. And then by 76, when I got back, 77, things had turned up a little.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We're looking a little brighter.
Mm-hmm. Warden A is still in the ascendancy at this point, but there's some waffling going on.
I think
design center philosophy.
The design center philosophy. Gene was always a bright is right, chrome is my favorite color kind of guy, and, you know, with good reason. You know, it worked like magic for years.
Yeah.
I'm not so sure. And since I'm retiring the 1st of January, I can speak freely that a blend of Gene's thinking and Jack's thinking probably would have been more appropriate than what we are now doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think we are almost too avant-garde.
Mm-hmm.
This is my own interpretation of the market. I think Uwe Bonson and his mob in Europe, you know, the whole, except for Uwe and some of his people, the whole European design team was transposed into the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And we have almost moved too fast into aero look and sacrificed utility and package room and things like that for it. And it's just it's a judgment call, you know, a narrow line you have to walk. Had we been a bit more conservative, somewhere between Gene Bourdonnais' philosophy and Jack Telnak's philosophy, we probably would have been in a better market position.
Mm-hmm.
So far, we've done fine. I worry a little bit about Taurus and some of the things coming on stream.
Mm-hmm.
Is my own feeling.
They're really
about it.
Sloping down.
They're very, very soft. Mm-hmm. You know, when we get there, 86, 87, they may be right. Maybe I'm the one that's getting old and conservative, but I have the feeling that there should have been a little more restraint, that we were trying to leapfrog the market, get out there, and we may be right, maybe, but I have the feeling that GM, with their little bit more conservative pacing, is probably more right than we are, as far as hitting the market at precisely the right time.
Mm-hmm.
We may do fine, I hope so, but I am...
There is a
little
softness appearing.
Yeah, very soft, very earnest. Whether it will catch on and really go depends a lot on our quality image, our prices, and our marketing. There's so many aspects of it.
This ascendancy, the winning over of the aerodynamic philosophy. Have you got any observation on how that came about? Terms of product planning and decision making at the top?
Well, I think it came out of sheer desperation.
Mm-hmm.
the emissions controls were forcing fuel consumption up and up and up, and mileage figures down, down, down. The government was insisting that it go the other way, that the size of the cars go down, 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 and the fuel consumption of the vehicles, you know, improved tremendously, and starting to set targets to hit. And the buying public couldn't care less. They wanted their big cars. They enjoyed the better mileage. But I think aero was just one of the many ways which you could counteract the tendency of the emissions controls and to degrade the CAFE of the company. And it was something that could be done quickly without a great deal of cost. It was just, you know, bend the tin in a different direction and do it more effectively. Whereas engine development and transmission development and emissions controls, the investments required were hundreds of millions of dollars. Whereas the designers could just, you know, in a matter of a few weeks or months, skin the car in a way that could be much more effective in terms of aerodynamics. So I think that probably when fuel was 30 cents a gallon, no one cared about aero, although there were a few that had a feeling like, gee, you know, if you're going to design it, why not do it efficiently, aerodynamically? The realization was there, but the need that necessitated the invention wasn't there. And it literally became a form follows function kind of kind of drill.
So far it's been successful.
Very successful, yeah. Yeah, it's given us a complete new feel to the vehicle. It's very fresh looking. It, as the cars get smaller, the car sizes have tended to become more of a golden mean. You know, there used to be a lot of difference between a little Pinto and the humongous Lincoln. Now between the Escort and the Mark 7, you know, there's not all that much difference in package. So the challenge to the designer is to continue to differentiate the car lines by virtue of handling the surface and the detail, where you really the package size isn't the distinctive thing anymore. So that it's become very challenging in terms of how do you handle the aerodynamics without them all looking the same. And we found that, you know, you can do quite a lot of latitude even in aerodynamics to tailor and finesse the cars.
Were you involved in that, in any of that mainstream, aerodynamic planning and execution?
No, not in the sense that, I went to the tunnels with the various vehicles to work them out, and I had an interest in it because I was at the University of Maryland where Glenn L. Martin gave $20 million endowment back there in the late 40s to, you know, excess profits from war production. And the University of Maryland tunnel was being built a year that I left and went to Pratt. So I'd always had that interest in it.
That became one of your chief testing.
That was the first tunnel that we got into full time on a contract basis with 3/8 models. And then we gradually went to LTV and most of the time to the low-speed wind tunnel at Marietta, Georgia, Lockheed, low-speed wind tunnel for most of the testing, and got a slow-scan TV and a telephone line hookup to monitor the development down there. And a lot of, the designers, of course, worked intuitively with the aerodynamics. And then the guys, the aero guys, would take them down to the tunnel, and we soon found that a lot of the intuition wasn't correct, that you could do a lot of things that finesse the models to a high degree in the tunnels and getting quite unexpected results.
Interesting concept that the designers always felt this way. They felt it was an evolution that was bound to come, and yet you were being continually thwarted by marketing specialists and product planners.
Well, the magic words that back there in the 50s and 60s was fill the cube.
Yes.
Give them more room in the car, make the car bigger and bulkier and more bang for your buck. You know, all the old cliches. And we just got horrendous size vehicles, you know, out of all proportion to their utility. Although the U.S. demanded big cars and long distances for long distances. But the CAFE constraints, the fuel embargoes and things like that,
brought us
corporate average fuel economy. Corporate average fuel economy, which is something that's really, you know, mandated by the government, has really put a lot of a lot more sense into the cars as far as thwarting this bigger is better syndrome, which can get out of hand.
So in effect, what you've been saying for the last few minutes is that the government mandate forced you to make this quantum leap into the air density.
Very definitely. And also the safety requirements gave us an opportunity to do things which we never could have done previously because of the cost constraints. But you had to do them, and consequently the cars cost 3 or 4 times as much as when we had the constraints on. Not all evolved because of safety, but because of inflation and a variety of factors. But we would have never had wall-to-wall all plastic panels, instrument panels in the cars, except for safety. There are many, many things that we would not have had that we have today that were we not challenged by the mandates, both environmental, governmental, and safety regulatory agencies had enforced us into.
Your career has taken an interesting turn at this point. You moved into an area which has been largely fairly stable in terms of design concepts, and yet you've obviously been involved with some really interesting projects.
Truck design, the vans are coming on very strong. So the Aerostar van is quite a challenging thing, and that was evolved basically in Don Kopka's area, the theme of it. But I inherited the production vehicles, and it's going to be an interesting vehicle. Even that has a C-sub-D or a coefficient of drag of 0.38. You know, and years ago the trucks had 5.5, and the cars were 5. And now we have a little van that's 0.38 C-sub-D, and the Thunderbird is 0.35, you know.
Incredible.
So it's, there, as you say, there's been great strides forward.
And this has gone far beyond Ken Spencer's old Minimax.
The Minimax is very, well, as I say, the Chrysler job is virtually a replica of the Minimax concept. And the Aero van has gone a little bit beyond that.
Can you give us a little bit of a background as to how you inherited this particular program or pushed it forward?
On the Aerostar?
The Aerostar, yes.
Well, really, I backed it up some because the feasibility of workout, there's a great void between the advanced concepts and what you can actually implement in a production way. And yet, in a sense, we lost a bit, but we didn't lose the theme at all, and have maintained a fairly good, you know, aerodynamic van out of the initial concept.
You have a good expectations for this model, which we introduced, I think, in the spring of '85.
Yes, it should be in the spring of '85 that the Aerostar is introduced. Yeah, it's late, but I think it'll carve out ultimately a pretty good niche in the market.
They've had some mechanical problems, I guess, not design problems.
No particular design problems. I've had some problems with one thing about slippery automobiles is they start showing up suspension deficiencies right away, crosswind handling and things like that, and mm-hmm. when you trim them low in the rear, or it's, you know, you can get into trouble more quickly. I guess it's any sophisticated thing, you can get into trouble more quickly than an unsophisticated mm-hmm. thing, and it's simply an evolution of that, I believe.
We have just a few moments left, Mr. Boyer. Can you sort of sum up your design philosophy as it's evolved over the years and how it was translated into the products that you were involved with?
Well, I think basically right from the 55 Bird on, I had a strong desire for a very clean, simple style of design. I was always much frustrated by overworked sheet metal, pods and booms and bombs that used to get put on the sides of things always struck me as being extraneous, and yet they had their function in terms of marketing and
yeah.
creating interest. But my philosophy is still a tendency to want a clean, simple form, one that's rather pure and functional. I don't think that's unique to me. I think most designers are not chrome oriented, but there's a necessity for car line and in series distinctions that have to be made and ways of identifying. So
much like the original Thunderbird.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Right.
Well, I think, would you say that the current evolution is really sort of a ancestor, or the Thunderbird is really sort of an ancestor?
Yes, I'd say it's an ancestor done with much intuition and little technical help, and the latter-day creations are much technical help and a matter of integrating all these, you know, things that are required today into the vehicle's design.
Do you see the aerodynamic concept continuing in the next decade or so?
Oh, I do, yeah, very definitely, yeah.
And you're happy with the results of your labors over the last 30 years?
Oh, yeah. You know, I would have been doing something like this just for fun if Ford Motor Company hadn't been paying me for it. I would have found a way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel marvelously well rewarded, you know, the fact that I could have had all the fun I did and had Ford foot the bill over the design center is just a remarkable thing for me.
Great. I wish we'd talk more about the Ranger and your input on that, if you could just very quickly.
Oh, the Ranger, the little Ranger? I really didn't have too much input into it. I was doing mostly interiors at
mm-hmm.
the time when the Ranger was done, so the Ranger interior is I had input into. The exterior, I will not have much input into that until 85, 86, 87, 88,
mm-hmm.
because of the time frame in which I've been working.
Mm-hmm.
87 F-Series, 88 Ranger, I'll have quite a lot of input into those
right.
vehicles. And they likewise are being influenced tremendously by aerodynamics,
mm-hmm.
fuel consumption considerations. So it all ties together. And the heavy truck, even the heavy truck, they're going into very much aerodynamic. There's tremendous savings. There's like 100% savings in fuel consumption that can be achieved on heavy truck, long haul, line haul trucks.
Mm-hmm.
So there's great opportunities for the guys to do some real things there. Is that it?
That's it.
Good.
I think we got
enjoy
it all.
Enjoy.